when we know that we have really loused up, well, the only thing we can do is to reach out and belt somebody else in the eye who generally is littler in one way or another, who has loused up even worse than we have. You know, this is just the way human nature works. And so Dirks, who had seen himself as, say, Leonard Bernstein early in his career, then he decided what he was going to do was to, he was really going to, well, he was going to compromise after he figured he couldn't make Bernstein. He was going to become William Cappell. And then he says, well, I can't make Cappell. Maybe I better settle for Van Cliburn. Well, he wound up with the Hammond High Band. Well, you know, I was telling you. So it would only come out at rare intervals, this terrible sense of defeat. And so here I am marching around. The band is playing Semper Fidelis. I'm playing On the Mall. 40,000 people are cheering this lone tuba player who is marching all by himself in a high wind, trying to catch up. And it seemed like an eternity until finally they decided to play football again and get away with my misery. And they marched me off, and Dirks was smoldering. He was really teed off. And Dirks came up through the band. We're sitting in the band section, you know, in the, how they sit in the stands. And I'm trying to pretend that I'm hiding behind my horn. And I'm trying to pretend also that the reason I got out of step and everything was that the wind caught me. See, I got caught in a terrible crosswind there with the sousaphone. And so I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden, Dirks banged me on the shoulder from behind. He says, I want you to come into the band room right after this game. I don't want you to go home and get in bus. I want you to come to the band room right away. Oh, boy. So I started to sweat. Well, the rest of the football game, of course, is a total blur in my mind. All I know is that after we're coming down, you know, and I'm watching, marching across the field, they're turning the lights out, in through the high school and through the long, dark hall, still wearing my sousaphone, walking along through endless miles of lockers, you know, and you can smell old ham sandwiches and old peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and tennis shoes and old burnt hopes and old teachers and everything else. And I'm walking, yeah, you can smell it all, seeing the lights are dark, and once in a while you see a janitor putting oil on the floor, and I'm walking down this long, long mile until finally I get down to the band room, and there's Dirk sitting there at his desk. He says, Shepard, I want you to know what you did tonight. Do you realize tonight, Shepard, you made me the laughing stock of all of Hammond? How do you think I felt tonight? Do you know that 40,000 people saw you tonight, and they did not blame you, they blamed me? Well, you're not going to get away with it tonight. And I'm just standing there shaking. I felt rotten. I was brown, blue, green, yellow. I felt, yeah, oh, another thing I must point out about a sousaphone player smells bad. I don't know whether you know that a sousaphone player makes you smell like old tarnished tin cans. Yes, it does, and it grinds itself into your hands. It does, and it up against your cheek. That's right, it's your left cheek where the horn just sort of leans down, comes up over your cheek and leans up there. Your cheek smells. You know, I was 25 years old before I stopped smelling like old belt buckles. It's a fact. Old brass belt buckles. Girls used to ask me, what is that shaving lotion you use? It's just very strange. Well, it was my old horn. Well, I'm standing there smelling the horn, and the horn is just sort of gassing away there. Do you know that for 20 minutes after a concert, if you come into a dark band room, you can hear the sousaphone still breathing? It's a funny thing about them. Yeah, they get up ahead of steam, seriously. And a sousaphone will just lay there and gasp for hours after you're through. Yeah, you can smell it. And they sort of gas away there in the dark. And I'm standing there with my old gasping sousaphone there, and Dirks looks up at me, and he says, you're not going to get away with it this time. He says, tomorrow morning, after the first period, I want you to talk to Miss Spencer. Miss Spencer, by the way, was at that point my homeroom advisor. I want you to tell Miss Spencer that you're going to come here immediately. Immediately, after the first class, after the first period, you've got to report to me. And I'm going to give you a note to tell you that. And he gave me a note, says, give this to Spencer. Well, the next day I gave her the note, and I showed up at his place, and this is exactly what he did to me. I'll never forget it. I will never, ever forget it. Dirks gave me a pail of water. He gave me a brush. He gave me about 3 cakes of big brown soap, the kind of soap that they use to wash floors and stuff with. And he says, I want you to get out now. He says, starting now, I have talked to Mr. Spohn, the principal, and I'm going to teach you about goofing off. You get 3 credit hours for this course, and that means that also includes practice. You goofed off the other day, and the guy over at the Red Rooster told me you goofed off. He said you were sitting in there drinking Cokes and malts, knocking down cheeseburgers when we were out rehearsing. and you made a fool out of everybody, including yourself, and especially the sousaphone section. They're all embarrassed. Ernest Dunker cried for 20 minutes this morning. Dunker, by the way, was the first sousaphone player. And so, anyway, he says, you're going to get out, you're going to wash the walls right in the main hall, and you're going to continue to wash the walls all day long until the eighth period today. Well, I said, do you know how it is to be humiliated before all the rest of the kids? Well, not only had I met him a fantastic louse-up at the football game, which was embarrassing enough, I spent the next 4, 6, or 8 hours, I don't know how, I just seemed like 400 weeks, out there with this scrub brush, brushing, washing the walls of the building inside, you know, with all the kids running up and down the hall, and there I'd be, you know, what's Shepard doing with the walls? What is this? Of course, before nightfall, 3,000 kids knew of what had happened. And I kept washing. Well, now, this is not necessarily a cruel and inhuman punishment. Now, I want to point out that punishments such as we know often hound us throughout all our lives. In short, I believe that there is a cyclic problem that deals with man. And it wasn't more than 5 years later, I am in the Army. This is up your alley, Al. I am in the Army, and I'm playing, you know, the Army, I don't know whether there's ever been a book written about Army life. There's been a lot of books written about war. There's been plenty of books written about the symbolism of man in arms and so on, but very few books ever written actually about Army life. Army life, you know, is like, say, how many books are ever written about the theater life? A lot of books are written about the theater. That's different. Very interesting difference. And so Army life is not what you think it is if you've gotten it by books. Army life is a long kind of a... It just flows endlessly around you. And after a certain length of time, the Army assumes its own reality. And things which happen in the Army, it's like being in college. You know secretly that college isn't real life, you know. And you also know secretly that the Army isn't real life. But after a while, you begin to accept it, and you begin to play that game. You have to exist in it. Isn't that true? Well, you exist. You have to exist in it, so you begin to play the game. You work from KP list to KP list. You work from casual party to casual party. You work from transfer to transfer. And you live in a very special world, and the war hardly ever enters any of it, nor does the end of what the Army's for ever enter it. Just like in most guys who are in college, the end of college doesn't really mean much. College becomes important. You know, passing the exam, getting the grade, getting the credit. The idea of what college means is a very tiny bit. You know, you never really, really concern yourself with this, you know? You don't. Not if you're having trouble. If you're real smart in college like you are, you know, you don't worry about the exams and that. You keep thinking what I'm going to do later. Yeah, bunk. You know, that's phooey. I know a better word for it. You show that kind of thinking that keeps thinking, no, not me. I'm proper and correct. Oh, yeah? Well, I know that I'd like to know how many guys' careers were decided on the basis of what was the easiest in college or what seemed to be the most convenient at the time. I'm just curious about that. I wonder how many guys got to be doctors, for example, because it was easier than fighting City Hall at home. I'm fascinated by that. I wonder how many guys became English majors because they made it pretty good with the first English teacher they ran into in their freshman year in college. And they wound up with a master's, or in some cases even a PhD in English. And then they stand from one foot to the next. And then at the age of 48, they are embittered readers of Jane Austen, who are stuck in some little high school somewhere talking endlessly about Sir Walter Scott. I'm curious about that. How many guys got sidetracked by that one little gimmick, that gambit? And, of course, all the rest of your life, then you have to pretend that you really wanted to do this. This is something I wanted to do. Well, the Army is very much like that in a way, and you find yourself doing obscene things, primarily because it is the way of the Army. You just do it. Well, one day I'm standing out in a formation. The Army is like life in one way. Lightning strikes when you least expect it. It just comes right out of the blue. And I'm standing there in formation, and the first sergeant, for some reason or other, there's a look in my eye. I'll tell you, I began to notice this in the Army. I did not notice it earlier. There is something about my eyes that somehow makes people either suspicious of me or they get angry. One or the other. Serious. I'm just telling you the truth. All of my, and I'm not referring specifically to my eye. I don't know what it is. It's an attitude or something that I didn't even know I had. And I began to develop it in the Army, and I didn't know it. So I had been transferred into a new outfit, and I had completely forgotten about what had happened with Dirks and the band. And I'm there about, maybe 2 or 3 weeks, and it is the most... I'll tell you, it's like... Any of you ever read Kafka and the story of the guy trapped in this unknowable world, this thing that he could not comprehend, and he was being accused of crimes over which he had no control, and he began to admit them? Well, somehow the Army can do that to you, and I had, without any warning, I had been transferred to an outfit called the 367th Heavy Signal Construction Battalion. Sounds very good, doesn't it? Well, let me tell you what it is, if you're interested in an outfit that has, what a coat of arms. Their coat of arms was just one single object. I will not describe it to you. It was very interesting. So I wound up in this outfit, and here's what they did. They had gigantic machines that dug holes in the ground. And they had machines that dug holes and set poles. Guys sweated and yelled. Have you ever looked down in the holes over here that they're making for these big buildings, and you see all those groundhogs with little tin hats on? Well, if you can imagine that happening to you in the Army, and with guys shooting at you at the same time. Well, that's the kind of thing it was. It was a totally thankless task. Totally. Now, you've seen in the Army, have you seen when Van Johnson is calling on the phone, he's talking to, somebody, let's pick John Wayne. He's calling John Wayne back up there, and the shot in the shell and is roaring over him, and guys are crawling over no man's land. And you notice that John Wayne is huddled in what looks like a little hut there, and the telephone is on the wall. Well, you'd be surprised. There were some guys who came there before those two guys showed up and built that little hut. Yeah, that's the outfit. And they got out there before anybody cleared the enemy out, and they put the wires up so that Van Johnson could call back to Gary Cooper. And that's the kind of outfit that nobody ever made a movie about this crew, ever. Because they weren't alive long enough, you see, to ever make a movie about. And, you know, you can't get very lyrical about a bulldozer. You can't get lyrical about guys throwing wire out of the back of trucks, you know, and ducking the carbine bullets at the same time. You just can't. You know, it's a kind of silly job. Really, you look silly doing it. And you can't get lyrical over, say, Tony Curtis going into battle with a pair of pole climbers on, and with pliers hanging all over him, you know, and he's got a wire cutter there, and he's wearing a pair of goggles, and they say, "Curtis, get out there. We want that field 32A1 wire strung now, because the Japs are coming." You hear it? And he goes over the top, and all you hear is the rattle of pliers. I mean, you know, they don't make movies like that. But there's guys doing this terrible stuff. And so I got into this horrible outfit. You don't know what an outfit. Well, every morning I kept waking up and standing formation. And it was always raining where these guys were. I think it was because they had sinned early in life. And it rained, and it was always cold, no matter where it was. And every morning I would get out, and this guy would look out of the crowd. The first sergeant is calling out roll, and he would say, "Is Shepard here?" And he had been very nice and very normal, calling everybody else. Just Shepard. "Shepard here." I'd say yes, or yeah, and he'd go on. Well, finally it hit. Lightning struck, and he said, "Is Shepard here?" I say yeah. He says, "Shepard, I want you to report to the OD immediately, if not sooner. Now get on the ball, go." So I turned around and back I went to the OD. Well, the OD said that I had been caught doing something, which is a long story. But he said, I'm going to give you a punishment. He says, "I'm going to make you remember this. And you're not going to get away with this kind of stuff. And you're going to remember it till the last day you are in the Army." And with that, he sends me down to the supply room, and he says, "I want you to draw a bucket, I want you to draw a brush, I want you to draw 3 cakes of GI soap, and come back here." Well, I go down to the supply room, and I say, "I want a bucket, I want a brush, and I want 3 cakes of soap." And I don't know whether you know anything about supply clerks, but there is just a perpetual smirk. These guys wind up in the promotion department of every place I've ever worked. Yeah, they do. There's a certain thing about Form 32s that develops it. So the guy looked at me. He knew what was going to happen. He says, "Here's your bucket, Mac." And he gave me the thing, and he gave me the thing, and he gave me the three cakes of soap. And 5 minutes later, I'm back talking to the second lieutenant. He says, now, he said, I want you to go down to the number one latrine. I want you to talk to Sergeant Barker, who's down there. And I want you to tell Barker that at last we're going to have the walls cleaned on the outside. The temperature, incidentally, is about 12 degrees above zero. So I go down to the latrine, and for the next solid week, I am cleaning the outside of the latrine with my brush. I have these two buckets next to me, one clear water, one soapy water, and I have a stack of brown GI soap next to me, which, by the way, raises blisters on rhinos. That stuff will blister paint. And I'm working on this, and it was a funny thing. About the first 5 or 10 minutes of brushing down this wall, it all started to come back to me. And it began to make a pattern. I was back in the band. I had countermarched when everybody else was countermarching. I had semper fidelis when everybody else was on the mauling. And I was brushing and brushing and brushing and brushing. It was not necessarily an inhuman punishment, but I suspect that the actual inhumanity of it all came in that I was reminded of something. I was reminded that I had loused up, that I would continue to louse up. Speaking of lousing up, we have here Esquire magazine tonight. And I would suggest if you're fascinated by Las Vegas, they have a big article on it, speaking of cruel and inhuman punishment. But while we're on the subject of being reminded, do you find that being reminded of yourself is what it really is? Do you think you really are what you think you really are? How do you think you really honestly look to other people? Do you really think they honestly love you? Do you honestly love them? Why should they love you? Do you really care about them? Do they care about you? I mean, is a penny saved the penny earned? Is honesty the best policy? Really? E pluribus unum. That's right.
Gene Shepherd, ex-tuba player, plays the nose flute, figuratively, maybe even actually, tomorrow night at 11:15.